Welcome to Honey from the Rock, a podcast devoted to Bible exposition. My father, Jack Christensen, preached expositionally for over 50 years, first as a missionary to Pakistan and later as a pastor in New England. His legacy lives on in me. He often began his sermons with a little expression, and now a little honey from the rock, taken from Psalm 81, verse 16. The psalmist wrote, "I would feed you with the finest of the wheat, and with honey from the rock I would satisfy you." Today, more than ever, we need to feed our souls on the words of God in the Bible. The crying need of the church is for God-centered, word-explaining messages. So now, my friends, a little honey from the rock. There is no attribute more comforting to his children than God's sovereignty, said Charles Spurgeon. God's sovereignty allows us to sleep at night, knowing he can handle what we cannot. 99% of the issues we fret about the most are blips on the radar screen of history. From God's perspective, he is following his grand plan for the universe, which is much bigger than any single person, any single nation, or century. We can sleep well because God has a plan. Daniel 2 pictures God's grand plan for human history in this colossal image that Daniel explains. I want you to use your zoom lens and zoom out until you and your whole family are just a speck on the computer screen, hardly visible at all, as we look at God's plan from God's perspective this morning. Daniel 2 pictures what Jesus called the times of the Gentiles in Luke 21:24. The times of the Gentiles is the period of time from 600 BC through today and into the future until Christ returns. The times of the Gentiles are still going on today. From the fall of Jerusalem in 586 BC until the return of Christ, Gentiles rule this world, and God's chosen people, the Israelites, are an oppressed nation. In this vision, God lays out the flow of history that covers this entire span. He predicts these events almost 600 years before Christ was born. This is truly a breathtaking vision of God's plan for human history, and we will sleep better at night when we understand his plan. We are living in the times of the Gentiles. Listen to Daniel 2, verses 31 to 35. "You, O king, were looking, and behold, there was a single great statue. That statue, which was large and of extraordinary splendor, was standing in front of you, and its appearance was awesome. The head of that statue was made of fine gold, its breast and its arms of silver, its belly and its thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. You continued looking until a stone was cut out without hands, and it struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay and crushed them. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were crushed all at the same time and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. And the wind carried them away, so that not a trace of them was found. But the stone that struck the statue became a great mountain and filled the whole earth." There are two overall themes that emerge from this vision, two overarching themes before we get into the details. First, human rule degenerates historically. As we move from the head to the feet of the image, we are moving from earlier history to later history. The image portrays the passage of time. As time passes, the metals in the image decline in value and atomic weight. So gold is at the top and is the heaviest metal. Clay and iron are at the bottom and are the lightest metals. The atomic weight of gold is over twice that of iron and 10 times that of clay. So the image is top-heavy with weak feet. Nations and kingdoms may seem powerful to those living at the time, but they are increasingly weak and impotent as time goes on. Human society doesn't evolve as much as it devolves. We might call it the law of social entropy. As nations grow stronger and empires grow greater, they also degenerate into tyranny, militarism, and oppression, or anarchy and chaos. Either route eventually leads to disintegration. This, my friends, is the common flow of human history. Things don't get better and better. They get worse and worse. Things may get better and better for periods within the history, but looked at from the zoom lens of heaven, human rule eventually degenerates and disintegrates. This should cause us never, ever to put our faith in any human government to solve our problems. In his book, Against the Flow, John Lennox writes, "Historians have spent much effort on the fascinating task of trying to ascertain why it is that civilizations rise, flourish, and then decay and die, like flowers in a field. One lesson of the image has been confirmed by subsequent history. No system of government has absolute value. All have strengths and weaknesses. They rise and flourish, then they decay and die like flowers in the field," he says. Human government degenerates over time, so never trust human government, any human government. But my friends, trust God, because God's power controls human history. The second overarching theme of this great image is that God knows exactly what is going to happen and is in control of human history from start to finish, as we shall see. In verse 37, when Daniel tells Nebuchadnezzar that he is the head of gold, he also tells him that the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, the strength, and the glory to you. To you, Nebuchadnezzar. Dr. Richard Swetson points out that the human body contains up to 100 trillion cells, and each cell contains a trillion atoms. These cells are continually being torn down and rebuilt in every human body. Every couple of days, the cells of our intestines are completely replaced. Every 7 years, we replace our entire skeletons. As he says, where do you think all that house dust comes from? He likens the body to a house. If my body was a house the size of Texas, then the walls of that house are knocked down and rebuilt every second. God designed this body and all its complexity. Even so, God designed and directs human history in all its variety. He knocks down and builds up empires all the time. Now, all that is by way of introduction this morning. Hang on to your seats, because we are about to fly through 2,500 years of human history and still counting. Daniel revealed to Nebuchadnezzar God's plan for human history, pictured in this colossal image. First, we have the head of gold, Babylon, in verses 36 to 38. Daniel begins his interpretation here. This was the dream. Now we will tell its interpretation before the king. You, O king, are the King of Kings, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, the strength, and the glory. And wherever the sons of men dwell, or the beasts of the field, or the birds of the sky, he has given them into your hand, and has caused you to rule over them all. You are the head of gold. Why was Babylon referred to as the head of gold? Was it just to patronize Nebuchadnezzar? No, there was great significance to this feature. The main god in the pantheon of gods at Babylon was Marduk. It was to Marduk that Nebuchadnezzar gave the glory for his victory over Yahweh, the Israelite God. The temple of Marduk in Babylon was called the house whose head is raised up. The temple's walls of gold and its alabaster pillars adorned a building larger than 12 football fields. Nabopolassar and Nebuchadnezzar built a ziggurat, or tower, to house the sanctuary of Marduk next to the temple. This tower was called the House of the Foundation of Heaven and Earth. The tower had a square base of 300 yards and was entered by 12 gates. It rose 7 stories into the sky and towered 300 feet in the air. On the top of the tower was a temple to Marduk made of blue enamel brick. It was the house of the uplifted head. Gold was used extensively in the city of Babylon. The historian Herodotus, who arrived on the scene 90 years after the time of Nebuchadnezzar, was astonished at the amount of gold in the city. Even buildings and walls were overlaid with gold. Babylon housed the hanging gardens that Nebuchadnezzar built for his wife. It is considered one of the 7 wonders of the ancient world. Babylon was truly a head of gold in the sequence of Gentile powers that would dominate the Middle East. It is still mythical in its value today. However, the Babylonian Empire only lasted about 70 years. The head of gold didn't last long in the history of humanity, but it left a lasting legacy of glory. Next on the image was the chest of silver, Medo-Persia, in verse 39. After you, there will arise another kingdom inferior to you, then another third kingdom of bronze, which will rule over all the earth. The head of gold was spectacular, but the kingdom did not last. It lasted only 21 years after the death of Nebuchadnezzar. In 539 BC, Cyrus the Great conquered Babylon. The chest of silver was actually a coalition of 2 countries, Media and Persia. If you look at the image, you will realize that the chest included the 2 arms, which is an apt description of the empire of Medo-Persia. The chief characteristic of this great empire was money, an apt connection to the silver chest, since silver was the currency of the ancient world. The Persian Empire lasted for 200 years in the Middle East, partially because they developed such an extensive tax base that the empire flourished economically. The taxation system of this empire is mentioned in Ezra 4, verse 13, and in Daniel 11, 2, as an incredibly efficient means of gathering wealth for the kingdom. Persia became so wealthy that it led to the conflict with Greece, the next empire. Verse 29 says that the Persian kingdom was inferior to Babylon. God certainly did not mean that it was inferior from the standpoint of military strength because Medo-Persia conquered Babylon, nor did he mean that it was inferior in size, for Medo-Persia was far larger in scope. Cambyses, the son of Cyrus, captured Egypt, and Xerxes and his sons later knocked on the door of Europe by repeatedly attacking Greece. This kingdom was inferior to Babylon only in that it was a partnership empire instead of a single nation empire. These alliances meant that instead of holding centralized power, there was shared power and diplomatic success. The city of Babylon continued to be the head of gold, even during the reign of the chest of silver, for she was the central city in the kingdom for centuries. Cyrus entered the city without much fight and actually declared himself to be the king of Babylon. So the head of gold continues through the reign of the chest of silver. Then we come to the belly of bronze, or Greece, in verse 39. The head of gold continues to dominate even during this phase, the next phase, for Alexander the Great dies in Babylon seeking to rebuild her glory. There's just something about this head of gold that mesmerized kings and generals. And Babylon remains a mythic city today. Saddam Hussein tried and failed to rebuild the city to its former glory in his time. However, Babylon continues to be a symbol of decadence and glory and power, of human decadence, as John in the book of Revelation will emphasize through the end of this age. Alexander the Great captured the imaginations of men and women for centuries. Throughout the Middle East, mothers still tell their children of the exploits of this great warrior called Iskandar. A popular Greek folktale tells sailors that if a mermaid arises to threaten their ship, cry out, "Alexander is alive and rules." His career covered just 13 years, and he died in Babylon at the age of 33. No general ever achieved greater loyalty or more impressive achievements than did Alexander the Great. For that reason, his kingdom is pictured in bronze. Bronze was the metal used in ancient times in the implements of war, and Greece is noted most for its incredible conquests under Alexander. The great philosopher Aristotle personally tutored Alexander, and by the time Alexander was 18, he commanded the left flank of his father's army in battle. After his father died, Alexander became king. In 334 BC, he left Greece with an army of 30,000 infantry and 5,000 cavalry. The army was small compared to both modern and ancient armies, which were based upon the principle of standing and fighting in one place. But Alexander was a constantly moving target with his highly mobile army. He and his army would travel 22,000 miles and fight countless battles in the next 11 years. Alexander met the Persian king Darius in the Battle of Issus in 333 BC. Alexander defeated him soundly and captured his pregnant wife, his mother, and his children. The Persian king sought to regain his family by offering Alexander half his kingdom without a fight. When Alexander read the letter to his council, his general by the name of Parmenio said that if he were Alexander, he would accept. "So would I," replied Alexander, "if I were Parmenio." And he rejected the offer. 2 years later, he met Darius in the Second Battle of Issus and maneuvered his small army brilliantly until the center of the Persian army, where the king sat on his throne, was exposed. Then he sent his troops straight down the throat of the enemy army at the Persian king, and the entire Persian army ran. Alexander continued to Babylon, and then deep into the mountains of what is modern Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India. He moved his army through mountain passes 14,000 feet up and came down through the famous Khyber Pass in the Indus River Valley into the Indus River Valley, not far from where I grew up as a child. He conquered everywhere he went. His feats were almost miraculous as he outmaneuvered generals on unfamiliar terrain. He led a charmed life, but after defeating an Indian prince, he turned back and died in Babylon of the swamp flu. He had established the greatest geographical empire of the ancient Near East, stretching from Yugoslavia to India and down through Egypt to Ethiopia and across to Libya. The belly of bronze included the two thighs. Alexander's empire did not succeed. It was quickly divided into four parts among his generals. While there were four parts of the empire, there were really only two parts of the empire that succeeded at all. Syria and Egypt eventually dominated, forming the Seleucid Empire, just like the two thighs pictured in the image. Next, we come to the legs of iron, Rome, in verses 40 to 43. Then there will be a fourth kingdom, as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron crushes and shatters all things. So like iron that breaks in pieces, it will crush and break all these in pieces. In that you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, it will be a divided kingdom. But it will have in it the toughness of iron, inasmuch as you saw the iron mixed with common clay. As the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of pottery, so some of the kingdom will be strong and part of it will be brittle. And in that you saw the iron mixed with common clay, they will combine with one another in the seed of men. But they will not adhere to one another, even as iron does not combine with pottery. Two legs of iron were an apt picture of the Roman Empire. Rome was the first empire to truly span both east and west under one control. In fact, at the end of the empire, in AD 364, the empire was actually split between the Western Empire with Rome as the capital and the Eastern Empire with Constantinople, which is modern Istanbul in Turkey, as its capital. Iron was a brilliant way to picture Rome. There was little of cultural brilliance that originated from Rome. Rome simply maintained and co-opted the cultural emphases of Greece. But Rome was built on one thing, and one thing only: power. Iron pictures power. It's not a precious metal. It's a metal of power. And Rome was built to crush all who opposed her. The Pax Romana, the Peace of Rome, was ruled by the power of the Roman army. The year was 146 BC. Two battles were fought that established the legs of iron as the next world power. The Battle of Corinth meant the end of Greece. The Battle of Carthage meant the end of North Africa. At the Battle of Carthage, the Roman historian Polybius stood by the Roman general as he watched the city set on fire. He had sowed salt over the entire city to curse the city forever, and then he burned it down. The Roman general cried as he watched the city burn, and pointed out that the burning of Carthage signified the eventual fate of Rome herself, in what he said is the inevitable fall of cities, nations, and empires. Kingdoms rise and kingdoms fall. Human governments are always unstable. Trajan's column still stands in Rome. On that column, 90 feet high, is a spiraling series of carved figures picturing the battles of Roman armies. There are 2,500 figures of conquest. In each set of pictures, there are Roman soldiers conquering enemy armies. Father Danube representing the Danube River, is at the bottom, watching in amazement as the Roman armies conquer Romania. Rome held power for 400 years, encompassing an empire from Egypt, across North Africa, up through Spain and all of Europe, even into England, across Eastern Europe and Turkey, down through Syria and Palestine to Egypt again. According to Cicero, the great Roman philosopher, Rome had one reason for its dominance. He wrote, "We have overcome all the nations of the world because we have realized that the world is directed and governed by the gods." Not quite right. God rules the rulers of this world, and Rome too would fall one day. The end of the image sees iron mixed with clay. The word for clay is not the soft, malleable clay that can be formed as you wish. This clay is hardened in the blast furnace. It is pottery clay. Pottery clay is hard and brittle. It shatters easily. So the end of the Roman Empire saw the iron mixed with pottery in the feet of the image. Hard pottery and hard iron do not adhere to each other, and so the end of the Roman Empire is seen to be an amalgamation of various forces that are weak and easily shattered. The Huns of the East rushed into southern Russia, destroying it as they went, moving on into Europe. The Visigoths of Germany fractured the Roman Empire even more. The Franks and the Gauls further tore apart the empire. Proud Rome would be sacked and burned repeatedly. And finally, in AD 476, the imperial symbols were sent to Constantinople. The Eastern Empire, called Byzantium, whose citizens called themselves Romans, lasted another 1,000 years until the fall of Constantinople in 1453. The European coalitions that destroyed Rome were like clay and iron. They did not mix, and they were weak and fractious. Gentile power growing out of the Roman Empire has been increasingly divided and brittle down through history. For the past 1,500 years, we have seen repeated attempts and brief successes of various Gentile powers in the Western world, but always they are feet of clay mixed with iron, so they never last. Sometimes I'm asked, what about the United States of America? Where do we fit? America is part of the feet of clay mixed with iron. She will not last either. America, too, will fall one day and cease to be a world power. All kingdoms have a shelf life. God stamps his expiration date on every empire. The rising and falling of kingdoms will continue until the final coalition of Gentile powers arises, what some have called the revived Roman Empire. It is a symbolic name because the end of the Gentile powers will be a power composed of both iron and clay, hard but brittle. And it is at that time that Christ returns to crush the entire image of Gentile domination. Look at verses 44 and 45. Here we see the rock that smashes Christ's kingdom. In the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed. And that kingdom will not be left for another people. It will crush and put an end to all these kingdoms, but it will itself endure forever. Inasmuch as you saw that a stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it crushed the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will take place in the future. So the dream is true, and its interpretation is trustworthy. The stone is cut out without hands and pulverized not just the last kingdom, but the entire image of Gentile domination. The times of the Gentiles will end. Not a trace of these world empires will be found when the stone pulverizes them into dust and the wind blows them away. This stone then became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. The Babylonians called the earth a mountain house, which is the place where the gods lived. They considered the earth to be like a great mountain, so this picture of the mountain would be the one that spoke to their understanding of what power was. The expression "great mountain" was a term the Babylonians used to describe the Sumerian god Enlil. The famous hymn to Enlil begins with, "Without Enlil, the great mountain, no city would be built." Daniel tells us that this stone represents a kingdom that will never be destroyed. It is a supernatural kingdom made without human hands, and it will exist forever. The kingdom will come to power at the end of Gentile domination and crush all world powers. The stone will strike the feet of clay and defeat the enemy suddenly and completely. The messianic kingdom will reign supreme. When? When will this take place? Many Christians have said that this took place when Christ came to this earth 2,000 years ago, and that he established his kingdom at that time. The kingdom, they say, is a spiritual kingdom that will eventually get stronger and stronger until it destroys the pagan powers of this world. I do not believe that this view is correct. Christ did not destroy Rome at his first coming. Rome continued to exist for 300 years beyond the coming of Christ, and Constantinople, the eastern part of the Roman Empire, did not fall until 1453. Gentile kingdoms still dominate the world and have for 2,500 years since the time of Nebuchadnezzar. We, my friends, are still going through the times of the Gentiles today. I believe that this stone represents Christ's second coming, when he will pulverize the nations of this world and establish his kingdoms on this earth. It is interesting that Jesus alluded to this twofold aspect of his power in Luke 20, verse 18, when he said, "The stone which the builders rejected, this became the chief cornerstone. Everyone who falls on that stone will be broken into pieces, but on whomever it falls, it will scatter him like dust." You see, the stone is first rejected, but later victorious. The messianic kingdom comes in two stages. Christ did establish the spiritual aspects of his kingdom at his first coming, and we are members of that kingdom. But Christ will one day set up his political kingdom, and when he falls in judgment on any nation, they will scatter like dust, just as Daniel predicted 2,500 years ago. God rules the rulers of this world. John Lennox observed that throughout history, it has been all too common for people professing Christianity to think that the system of government that happened to be in power in their nation, in their era, was nothing less than the kingdom of God on earth. Indeed, the very concepts of Christendom and the Holy Roman Empire embodied that notion. Even today, it is sometimes difficult to persuade Christians that their own particular form of government, say Western liberal democracy, for example, is not the kingdom of God on earth. It is so easy to think that at last we have got it right. Wrong. We will never get it right. But God does. He rules the rulers of this world. His kingdom is supernatural, and one day will smash all the kingdoms of this world with supernatural force. My friends, if God can direct the universe through millennia of history, don't you think that God can handle whatever you face today? What does this all mean for us? It means rest. W.C. Fields used to comment, "The best cure for insomnia is to get a lot of sleep." The psalmist wrote in Psalm 127:2, "It is vain for you to rise up early and retire late to eat the bread of painful labors, for he gives to his beloved sleep." Sleep. Dr. Richard Swenson comments, "Perhaps part of his reason for creating sleep is to teach us to trust his sovereignty. It takes an act of faith to quit at the end of the day, without all our problems solved, our to-do list completed, or the world fixed. At that point, we must trust God to run the universe without our help." A daily reminder of who is in charge. The lesson is simple. Work hard and go to bed. So, my friends, sleep well tonight. God's got a plan. Sleep well.